Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And Chris, when last we spoke, the Mets were beginning their series with the Miami Marlins. That series was split, and then they headed into a series in Atlanta against the Braves. And I would say the mood around Mets Twitter was surprisingly bleak, and that's for a Twitter experience that is usually bleak. But people were talking about how the Mets were going to get swept. This was the end of the season. There was a lot of sort of very, very apoplectic, just rage at the idea that whenever anyone would say, like, oh, the Mets are going to do well, people would just be like, what are you talking about? It's the Braves. It's Atlanta. And the Mets won 2 of 3 in Atlanta, and they're still in first place, and the Braves didn't look impossible to beat. So my question to you is, how good does it feel to be right?
It feels very good, especially under those circumstances. As you said, the Braves did not look like some juggernaut team, some team that the Mets couldn't match up well against, couldn't beat. Obviously, they have a lot of games left against each other the rest of the way, but this was as encouraging as it could get. And I love Luis Guillorme. They won a game with Guillorme batting in the cleanup spot.
Yes, they did.
And he had a nice series at the plate, too.
He did. In that game, he had an RBI from the cleanup spot. So, you know, I guess it wasn't the terrible decision I thought it was.
Yeah, I mean,
it still isn't a good decision, but that's a whole other story.
When the lineup looks a little more depleted, whether by absence or injury or both, I think it might make sense to have Guillorme hit higher in the order. As sort of a regular thing, because he's shown a pretty good ability to get on base. He's still hitting for a high average. The fact that there's a useful offensive component to his game on top of what he's doing in the field is just such a major bonus. So, objectively, they had him batting cleanup, and they won that game and scored 7 runs in it. Mm-hmm. So, I think the combination of just expecting the worst against the Braves, especially in Atlanta, and sort of the recent, I want to say dramatic, an appropriate word, dramatic negativity about the offense, was like the perfect storm to expect terrible things to happen for a lot of Mets fans. And I'm glad it didn't turn out that way.
And look, I get the fear. I just want to say that, like, I don't think that anybody is crazy for thinking, like, oh man, it's probably gonna be a tough series against the Braves in Atlanta. They're historically tough in Atlanta, and the team is so hot right now. I totally get that, but I think there's a difference between being afraid of something or expressing doubt about something than there is being just like unbelievably convinced that there's no way the Mets could win. Is what we were seeing, which is a very different story.
Yeah. And even with some offensive struggles recently, the Mets this morning are still 4th in baseball, all of baseball, with 4.73 runs scored per game. The only teams that are significantly ahead of them, if you want to call it that, are the Yankees with 5.23, so a full half a run more per game. And then the Dodgers at 5.08. The Giants are right there at 4.78. So I don't know. I don't know how else to put it. That this is a team that is scoring runs. Whatever perceived slump or maybe real team-wide slump may have existed for some period of time, just objectively, this is still a team that's up there in this 2022 season when it comes to scoring runs.
Yeah, and I do think that the lack of scoring runs, I do think it's problematic, and I do think, not because of any particular game or any particular stretch of game. It's just that, like, when you see, for instance, you know, McNeil's on the paternity list right now. He'll be back. This is not a problem that needs to be worried about. For a couple of games, they were without McNeil. Guillaume is more than fine to step up for McNeil for a couple of days. James McCann is not Mike Piazza behind the plate, but Mazzica is a downgrade from McCann. But those are things that, you know, injuries happen, babies happen, apparently. You know, that sort of stuff is not any cause for worry. To me, the bigger cause for worry with the Mets offense is just the relative black hole that the DH spot has been for them. I think if the Mets can address that, then I think the lineup looks incredibly different. I think that will make me feel a lot better about the Mets offense, because in a game, let's not even talk like yesterday's. Let's talk about like over the weekend. You know, when Marte and McCann went down in the game against the Marlins, all of a sudden you're looking at the lineup and you're thinking, well, aside from, you know, whatever it was, the top five people, and that's messed up because I think NCRT went into the two hole when Marte came out. But like, aside from the four or five very established hitters, everybody else seemed like either an automatic out or a long shot to get a hit. I know that's not the way it really is, but that's the perception of the bottom of the lineup. But all of a sudden, if you put another real bat in there, I think that the fear goes away. Now, to be fair, I don't think the fear has necessarily correlated to performance. I think the Mets, as you said, they're still scoring plenty of runs right now. But I think for a fan base that is used to the team having a that is used to the team not doing everything it can do in an offseason to prepare for success, see the bullpen of 2020, for instance, it becomes just very, very clear that there is something to be said for getting another bat before the playoff real push happens here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And sign me up for that. I'd love for them to be third or second or first in runs scored per game. And it's nice to look at it and say, hey, that could be attainable. First might be tough in that particular metric, just because there's a lot of games in the books and the Yankees are a very good team and play half their games with some very easy home run opportunities.
Yes.
Both of those things can be true.
Yes, absolutely. Especially because the Yankees this year are just, I mean, we have not really seen a team offensively this strong in a while. This is some next level offense from the Yankees right now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they have been very good. We'll get to talk about them a little bit more when the Subway Series rolls around, although I don't know, I'm pretty burnt out on it at this point, but
yeah,
it'll be a thing that we talk about in a couple of weeks.
Let's briefly talk about the weekend series with the Marlins. You know, it's a bit of a bummer that they lost two of the games against a team that they probably should have won at least three. And you and I had talked about it after Thursday night's win. We felt like, all right, now they're in line to win three games. And if you looked at Taijuan Walker's line on Sunday's game, the Mets should have absolutely won that game. It again came down to the bullpen blowing it. Do you have any sort of overall thoughts on the baseball play between the Marlins and the Mets this weekend?
Nothing too insightful. it was just one of those things. It was definitely a letdown because I think going back to before that 10-game stretch started, 7-3 was something that I had thrown out on the podcast, and then they came just shy of finishing exactly that. Obviously, you root for 10-0. 6-4 is really nothing to complain about too much, but it was right there. 7-3 would have been really nice, but you're gonna occasionally lose a game you should win. I promise not to talk about the Yankees again after making this comparison, but they lost a game to the Reds the other night. It sometimes baseball just goes that way, and it's annoying. But winning the series, if I had to choose between 3 out of 4 from the Marlins, but not winning the series from the Braves.
Oh, of course.
You know, obviously, I'll take that sequence, even though the number of wins is the same for the Mets in the end. I guess I don't have anything too crazy about that series. I'm very glad they won on the Keith Hernandez number retirement day. And just on that note, and this is not a complaint, it's just an observation that it's a little surreal to see him have the ceremony and then hear him in the booth 2 days later working again. And, you know, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled that his number got retired and that happened. I'm thrilled that he's right back in the booth. It's just, mind-bending when you transition from the star of the show out on the field and then just back to the booth talking about regular season games.
Yeah, it is a little strange. I will grant you that. So I was at the Keith Hernandez game. It was great. I had never been to a number retirement ceremony before. I missed the Kuzman and Piazza ones, and I don't know why I would be at another team's number retirement ceremony. But it was really special, and I felt that everybody there was really appreciative of what Hernandez has done for the team, both like on the field and also in the booth. It felt like a real celebration of a player and a piece of our franchise that was really just, it was very, very much, it was very, very well done. I thought that it was, there was something, the video that they produced was incredible. It was really, really well put together. The people they brought out for the ceremony with Mookie Wilson, Ed Lynch, Ronnie and Gary, Piazza, Steve Cohen. I thought it was a nice crew of people. I thought that there was a certain fun to it, but also a certain gravitas to it. It was a really well done event. I am not used to the Mets doing their history proper and celebrating their history. It's been so long since they have done, and under the Wilpons, it just seemed like they had no interest in celebrating their past unless they absolutely had to. And this felt like the dawn of a new era in that way. It really felt like this is the beginning of them maybe really going for it in terms of celebrating what it means to be a Mets fan and celebrating who the Mets were and are. And I love that. I think that's fantastic. And then the way the game ended, I mean, yes, you know, it's always a bummer to watch the Mets blow a couple of leads. But did you see the crazy stat about the end of the game?
I did.
So tell me if I'm getting this right. The last time the Mets came back to score two runs in the bottom of the ninth. It doesn't matter because it was extra innings. So came back to win in a walk-off fashion because of an error was the game six of the 86 World Series. Is that the correct? Did I get that all right?
It's along those lines. Yeah, I forget if it had something to do with, you know, specifically a wild pitch being involved in the inning, or you know,
right,
or what. But yeah, along those lines, that specific way of winning hadn't happened since then. And Gary, I didn't notice it in the moment, I'll admit, but Gary called it like the end of that game.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. He made the call on that. Winning run scoring, using phrasing that alluded to the 86 game. So that was very cool. And of course he somehow was on top of that. Not only is he good at actually calling the game, but he's as good as anybody out there when it comes to contextualizing the Mets.
Yes. Yes. Along the lines of him being so good at calling the game, I also want to point out that during Wednesday's game, there was a problem with the video feed for a while. And so there was just an SNY, like a static SNY logo. And Gary and Keith called the game like radio for a couple of minutes. And Keith had no idea what to do. And Gary instantly slid back into radio Gary mode. I could not believe how fast he slid back into that. It was pretty impressive to watch just how his brain went back to something he hasn't done in almost 20 years.
Right. Yeah. On the baseball side.
Yeah.
For sure. And the funny part of all that to me was in the middle of it. He said, Keith, you know, you're still allowed to talk.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Just like, just didn't know what to say. And it's funny because when you listen, there's definitely a difference. But when you listen to Gary calling a game on TV, he does say a lot in terms of the play-by-play. He's fairly descriptive. You know, I find that if you're cooking dinner or taking care of something else, or it's a day game and you're working and you can't really focus your eyes on the game, you can still listen to Gary and have a very, very good idea of what's going on from, you know, from his play-by-play on the TV broadcast. Mm-hmm. But you're correct. He still shifted into full-on radio mode, and the audio that was making it through on SMY sounded like it was from the 70s.
It did, yes, yeah.
So it just obviously they're not going to intentionally do that, but if it happened once or twice more, I wouldn't mind. I do think it is the best sport for audio-only experience.
Agreed, yes. I have long wished that there be a game or a series or even an inning where the TV and radio guys swapped.
Yeah.
And that would be fun. Because for some people, you know, especially now that I work from home, I almost never get to hear Howie Rose call a Mets game. Because I'm home during the games. And and I'm sure there are people who are always in the car during Mets games, or, you know, they can't watch the games because it's blacked out because of MLB.TV's draconian rules, and so they would love to hear Gary Cohen call a game. So yeah, make that happen, Mets. Let's do that.
I'm Shireen Ghaffari.
And I'm Alex Heath. We're hosting Land of the Giants, a podcast about the biggest tech companies of our time. This season, Meta, formerly known as Facebook. It's a company in a particularly controversial and vulnerable moment. Mark Zuckerberg is placing a multi-billion-dollar bet towards an imagined metaverse future. Meanwhile, the rest of us are still grappling with what he's already built.
This season, we're going to talk to the executives steering Meta's biggest decisions. And you'll hear from some of Meta's sharpest critics, its former employees.
We'll explore why Zuckerberg is taking the company in a bold direction and how Facebook's past will inform its future.
Land of the Giants, the Facebook Meta disruption. From Recode, The Verge, and the Vox Media Podcast Network. This season is sponsored by Klaviyo.
Subscribe for free wherever you listen and get our first episode on Wednesday, July 13th.
I'm David Pierce, and I want to tell you about The Vergecast, the flagship podcast of Sentient AI. No, I'm kidding. The Vergecast is a show from The Verge where we talk about what's going on in tech. The big stories, the best gadgets, the worst gadgets, and basically all the ways tech might change your life in the future. Neelai Patel and Alex Kranz are my co-hosts, but they're apparently too important and too busy to be here recording this promo with me.
Sorry, the editor-in-chief.
You got this, David.
On Wednesdays, the Vergecast crew dive deep into the stories The Verge covers, from what's happening at the latest Apple event...
I am standing in the spaceship at Apple.
...to whether you should be taking phone calls from your earbuds at really loud coffee shops...
Are you hearing me clearly?
No.
No?
...to why it's so hard for the internet to just tell you what restaurant to go to.
It is not a straightforward solution.
Then on Fridays, Neelai, Alex, and I spend some time hanging out and making sense of all of the biggest tech news of the week. I hope you'll come listen and hang out with us. Again, that's The Vergecast, like Verge and podcast put together. You get it. The Vergecast. See you there.
So we had mentioned last week the idea of maybe calling up, or just the discussion about calling up Francisco Alvarez at some point this season and talking about whether he should be catching or DHing or both, blah, blah, blah. But then this week we have, with the injury to James McCann, a need for both a hitter and a catcher. So, Chris, how do you feel about Francisco Alvarez being called up sooner than later? Do you have different feelings about that now that McCann is out for a potentially significant amount of time?
Yeah, I'd say at this point, just do it. I don't know. I don't think... he's only been in AAA for 7 games. He hasn't really hit a lick there yet, but I don't think you're going to destroy him by giving him that shot. And And we love Patrick Mazika. We love the random walk-offs that he's been involved in. There is a t-shirt with Pat Mazika on it. But having said that, I don't know, man. I think I'd be okay with giving Alvarez a look. And everybody would just need to treat it accordingly. If he looks great, hey, he's 20 years old. He's a catcher and he made it to the big leagues and he looks great. Awesome. And if he doesn't, okay, that's fine. He's still just 20 years old. He can go back to Syracuse, keep working on adjusting to that level of the game. And I just think there is some value in getting a taste of what he looks like in the major leagues right now before the trade deadline hits. And really, you only have a couple weeks worth of games, but between the All-Star break and then the Mets schedule, again, they have a stretch coming up like they did in late June with a lot of off days. So, the All-Star break happens. That's 4 days. Presumably, they're not going to call up Alvarez for this Cubs series. So you get to three against the Padres after the break, day off, two against the Yankees, day off, and then three against the Marlins, and the deadline is August 2nd, so one against the Nationals, but there's not a whole lot of time there, but I would still be okay with getting a look and trying to see. If you give him that look and he really isn't hitting at the major league level, okay, now you really know that you might want to trade for a catcher, even if it's not Wilson Contreras. Obviously, he is the most appealing option because of his bat, and there just aren't many catchers who can hit right now. But yeah, I'd be okay with it from that perspective. How about you? Any more or less hesitant to do that?
I'm a gambler, Chris. No, I'm not at all. I'm the most risk averse person I know in the entire world. I don't think that the narrative of if you call up a player too soon, it's going to fuck them up forever is necessarily true. I also don't believe in calling up anyone who's having a good series in A-ball, because why not, right? I think that there's a lot of wisdom in what you said, which is that there's a short period of time here where we can attempt to bring him up and see if he's showing great promise right now. If he's not, Mets fans just have to chill out and realize he's very young and he may still develop into something more than we're going to see in his first major league go around. And that's true if he's called up now or September 1st or next year, right? Like, I think that that's just the way it is. And there's nothing he can do one way or the other that will truly cement his forever status as a Met. As even if he comes up and lights the world on fire, how many one-season wonders have there been over baseball history? I mean, literally, the history books are peppered with players who just did, who had one great season. So I don't think that is necessarily I don't think either extreme is likely to play out over the course of Alvarez's entire career. I think what you do get, though, is you get an instant answer to the immediate needs of your team. If he's hitting the ball and he's doing halfway decent at catcher, well, that means that you have a lot more options now going into the break, going into the trade deadline, rather, in terms of what you're looking for. I also will say that there is this, I think, reluctance to call him up because of, wanting to keep him down a little bit longer so the team can control him a little bit longer in terms of, service time. And while other teams do that, that's people still thinking like the Wilpons own this team. And I think if he is the player that we think he is, I don't think we have to worry about Steve Cohen letting him walk at a certain point. I think Cohen has more than enough money to do the right thing and keep him around if he is actually, if that is what he is meriting, right, on the field. So long story short, I agree with you. I think now is the time to bring him up just to see after the break, you know, especially have they given any real timeline on McCann? I know they just said more than a 10-day.
Right. Yeah, no, I don't think there has been. I mean, you hear Oblique and Max Scherzer is the freak who made it back faster than ever
right.
expected, but pretty much nobody else comes back faster than the normal timeline. And obviously, I would think that injury would affect you no matter what position you play, because pretty much everything involved in the game of baseball involves some kind of twist or torque or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would be surprised if he's back before, I don't know, September 1st.
Yeah. And so, not that I think, I think if the Mets add another bat, whether it's Alvarez or otherwise, I think they can survive through the end of the summer with Nito and Mazika as their catchers. However, they cannot survive. Survive is a strong word. I would feel much better about their chances both during the season and especially during the postseason with another bat. So I don't think that bringing up Mazika is going... I mean, Mazika, my goodness. Bringing up Alvarez is going to actually solve the if they bring up Alvarez and he is hitting, I still think they should go out and get another bat. But if they don't call up Alvarez, that need is even greater right now.
Yeah, I think that's very fair.
And we'll talk more in the coming weeks about other bat targets as well as other bullpen targets, because I think those are clearly the two needs for the team. I think they need another bat for that DH spot, just because there is so little happening from Dom Smith or JD Davis right now. I mean, you had the occasional flash here and there, but neither has been able to put together any sort of consistency. So that's definitely necessary. But anyway, it is time for our music picks. So, Chris, what is your pick for this week?
So, I'm going to tie together this past weekend and a somewhat related to Mets history note, only because it was recorded in 1969, the year of the Mets' first World Series championship. It technically is a box set, and I will admit I do not own a physical copy of it because they're very hard to find. But over the weekend, I had the opportunity to see and photograph Phil Lesh and friends. Phil is the bassist from the Grateful Dead. He's 82 years old now, I think, and still playing shows, played 3 hours and 15 minutes in total with a break in the middle. And just seems like such a good person every time you see him. And it was just a lot of fun. Like one of the nicest concert crowds we've ever been in. Really just a pleasant experience, and getting that chance to get up there with the camera made it even that much better. So if you have the opportunity to catch him playing now, I still strongly recommend it. And my recommendation on the album front is the complete Fillmore West 1969, the complete recordings is the full title of it. There are 10 discs and a bonus disc, but it's basically taken from a run of four shows at the Fillmore West in February of 1969. In particular, disc four of that set is just really my favorite recording of the Dead. That's it for the other one, Dark Star, Saint Stephen, the 11, Death Don't Have No Mercy, all strung together straight through, and just I have nothing against the sort of lighter, happier sounding era of the Dead, but this is just heavy psychedelic rock. Like there's no other way to put it. It's not metal, but it's just such a good sound. The actual box set had come out on CD because that's what everybody was buying at the time it was released, and I think there's only 10,000 copies of it, so it can be a little tough to come by. Some parts of it have been released on vinyl since then, like individual shows out of the four shows that were part of this run, and then there's like a condensed version of it You know, that might be two or three discs, but if you can find it on the internet one way or another, whether it's a purchase or a download or whatever, I very much recommend the whole box set. And again, especially disc four.
In a nice little bit of synergy, my pick this week is also from 1969. And it is, in the most tenuous way, Grateful Dead related as well. In that, I play in a cover band every now and then, and we're gearing up for something in September. So we started getting together every week and rehearsing, and we play a lot of Grateful Dead stuff. That is the connection here. But we're also always looking for new songs. And so I had suggested that I want us to try to get slightly funkier, which as five middle-aged white guys is not the easiest thing in the world to do authentically. But so I am looking for, you know, songs that we can play that would be fun, that wouldn't be embarrassing to try to funk up a little bit. And so one of the ones I suggested this week was a song that only one other person in the band had ever heard before. And I could not believe that, because to me, this is a classic band and a classic album. But the rest of the band looked at me like, no, I don't know that song at all. And that is Sissy Strut by The Meters. Meters are a New Orleans funk band. Funk is maybe not the right word for them. I think that's a fair term for what The Meters are. But Sissy Strut is one of those songs that's been used in 4,000 movies and TV shows and, probably commercials over the years. Like, it's just they are just the... It is the soundtrack of so many things. And their first album, which is self-titled, called The Meters, is one of the great records of all time. One of the greatest great funk records of all time. And it is, let me see how the best way to describe this. There is not a lot of, there's a little bit of guitar solo and keyboard solos in it, but it's really just the band like locking into a riff and just doing sort of variations on that riff. It is tight and it is funky and it is, it's unlike other funk in so many ways. It is like funk distilled down to its most pure form. For the first album, it is just organ, drums, guitar, and bass, and there are no vocals. It's just instrumental, beautiful, and goddamn, makes me want to dance. It is fantastic. If you don't know Sissy Strut, maybe you've heard Live Wire. That's also appeared in a couple of films. And their whole career is really worthwhile. But this first album is, I mean, I want to say, though, the entire record's like 35 minutes. And that's 12 songs. And that's, you know, every song kind of breezes by the end of it. Like, oh, I wish that song went on for longer. But yeah, just really good New Orleans funk. It's produced by Alan Toussaint, who is, you know, a New Orleans legend. And Art Neville of the Neville Brothers plays organ in the band. Just fantastic stuff. If you are not familiar with The Meters, please rectify that. It will make your life better. And so that's a double 1969 shot of Music Club Rex. Music pick. You know what I mean?
Yes.
We both picked 69 albums. Yeah.
Yes. The Meters are great. And just the notion of a few middle-aged white guys trying to get funkier, all I could think of off the top of my head was Homer and Grand Funk Railroad.
Yes. Of course. I actually, so there's actually a woman who sings in the band sometimes, and when I mentioned getting funkier, she said, what about some Grand Funk? And I said, that is not funky. I said, funk is in their name, but they are not funky. Please don't do that to me.
Right.
You know, no, I suggested a Dr. John song, a Funkadelic song, and a Meter song. That is funky.
Yes. All around.
Yeah. If we didn't already both pick Maggot Brain, I'm trying to get us to play Can You Get to That from Maggot Brain. So I would have picked that as the pick for this week.
Nice. Yeah, no, it's also ties in all of the pre-show music on the PA for Phil Lesh on Friday night was Funkadelic.
Oh, really?
Yeah, all of it. Just like playing through a few albums. I was like, this is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that is some good pre-show music for sure. This is a conversation we could probably talk about for longer, but I know we should get out of here. But I was going to say, I love when The pre-show music has nothing to do really with the music that is going to be played at the show, but is music that gets you excited for the show. And Funkadelic before a Phil Lesh show is like the perfect combination of that.
Yeah, yeah. And nothing worse than like people tailgating in a parking lot or the bar that's playing all music by the band you're about to see.
Yes.
When you stop for a drink before the show. Just no, don't do that. Stop it. We know. We all know who we're going to see.
Exactly. Exactly. It would be different if you were playing, I guess, maybe stuff that like you know would never get played. Like, you know, if the band has not played a certain song in 20 years, maybe you tailgate to listen to that song, but just expand your horizons, dude. Not you, dude. The fictional dude that we're talking about.
Yes.
Anyway, thank you for listening. We appreciate it. Go to AmazingAvenue.com for game recaps, news, analysis, etc. We are getting ready for the All-Star break. We should try to do something fun for the All-Star game next week. I don't know what it's going to be yet, but we should do something fun. So let's work on that. Also, follow Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can find this show on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts. Wherever you get podcasts, you can find it. Please let us know if you can find the show on your podcatcher of choice. We'd be happy to get that looked into for you. Go to Twitter to follow Chris at Chris McShane. I am over there as well at Brian Isenap. And until next time, let's go Mets.